time we share, with love and care, oh, we give thanks. For this precious day, oh, we give thanks. For this precious day, we're all gathered here, in those far away. For this time we share, with love and care, oh, we give thanks. For this precious day.
Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan Sunday Service. I'm Jennifer Bryan, a member here. And you may direct your attention to the order of service. You may direct your attention to the order of service for announcements. Since last week's sermon analysis of our first vision statement, I've been reading it and thinking about it a lot, learning it. Before last Sunday, I had not noticed it printed weekly on our order of service. And in studying it, I have grown to love it. Several years back, a committed group of members penned it, and I think it really defines much of what we think and try to do. My personal favorite is the fifth, Builders of Bridges Across Faiths and Boundaries to Honor Our Shared Humanity and Common Values. For me, the six pieces on the back are enfolded in the words equality, love, creativity, and education, cornerstones of a sort. Our minister, Reverend John Stone, will be speaking of these over the next weeks. I hope anyone visiting will be back to hear some of these. Please stand as you are able for opening hymn number 94. This is the time in our service where we share our joys and sorrows that are closest to us. Please wait for the microphone. Raise your hand if you have something you would like to say.
I'm Laurie Cross. I'm the chair of the Aesthetics Committee. And I just want to alert those of you who are so kind to give us art pieces to show, because that's going to change our show the 1st of March. So all of you who have any interest in art, please see me, Ann Marchin, Harriet Yankee, or Kim will help you with the with hanging them. But I want you to notice the deadline is February the 28th. Thank you.
Ann Cowan here. I had sort of a traumatic event this week, of which I think I may be fully recovered, but maybe not. I still feel my space has been violated. Friday morning, I came downstairs after showering, dressing, and all, and I found a strange man sleeping on my couch in the living room. And it was rather startling. I did about 3 takes to make sure I wasn't imagining it. Went back upstairs and called the police, who handled it all very well. But this person, who had been so drunk, when he woke up, he had no idea where he was, how he had gotten here, no memory of the night before. A young man. He had come in my back door, and those of you who know my house know that when you come in the back door, you have to turn, go turn again, go up some steps, turn through the kitchen, turn again into the dining room, turn again into the living room to my couch. No lights were on, and yet he made it to my couch. I don't know how he did, but anyway, I am recovering.
Michael Oldfather, some of you may remember Jack Warren, who was a longtime member of this group, married to Alice Stockwell. They owned the house on the corner of 17th and one block south of Anderson, whatever that is. Big white house there that was built by Jack's widow, or Jack's wife, and her mother as a boarding a rooming house for men when there weren't many dorms at K-State. And yesterday at auction, Jack's house was sold at for a very good price, much higher than I thought it would go for. And Jack bought a muscle car. Jack's 84. He bought a 2002 Pontiac Trans Am. The last year it was made with a motor so big you can hardly get it under the hood. Black convertible, black leather. And so the auction began for the car. And it sold for $22,400, which is a good deal more than book value for that. And I was the one privileged to go tell Jack how much that sale had brought in for those two items alone, and how he was relieved that it was so much higher than he expected. It'll pay for a lot of months at Metal Ark. Those of you who know him, he's in what house? Miller House, and he appreciates visits. Stop in and see him sometime.
I have a joy that I am going to start practicing violin lessons now.
I'm Michelle Dormany, and I have a joy. I gained a son-in-law on Friday.
Well, I'm going to pass this to Courtney, but it should not go unsaid that last night's dinner, Mardi Gras dinner, was well attended and enjoyed by many. And we should all thank Courtney for her leadership in staging this event, which involved a lot of people. Now I'll let her be more specific.
I had such a good time last night, and it only comes together because of everybody that's involved, and I don't need to get any of their credit because it wouldn't happen without all the people that came to attend and had fun, and all the people that did the cooking and the decorating and all the stuff that goes into it, and it's a lot of work, but when it all comes together, it's a lot of fun too. So thanks for letting that happen.
Ruby Smith has a joy that she'd like to share.
My birthday's tomorrow. Oh.
I'd like to add my own two joys to this. It's all part of the same. Our member, Sabrina Boker, is in Houston right now at a writer's conference. And it's a joy that she has found something that she really enjoys doing and does well at. And the joy that actually tops that for me out of this group is that Sabrina is staying with my brother in Houston. And one would have to know the history of my brother to know why this is a joy. And I think it's probably the top joy I've ever said in here. And although I expect many more joys in my life, I don't think any will reach the magnitude of that one. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, as the choir is seating, please, children, come forward for the story of all ages about trees and art told by Mrs. Beeman using Lori Cross's piece of art.
Oh my gosh, look at all the youth in our group. You guys are amazing. Hello to all of you. Are any of you artists?
Well, hello.
Oh my gosh. Well, lots of you. Well, have any of you drawn pictures? Come on, probably all of you. Or made something? Everyone has some artistic ability. I know all of you have made something, yes. And do you have a favorite artist? Any of you have a favorite artist? Jacob?
My favorite artist is me.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's good. You never know what you're going to make, do you?
I don't know any other artist's
name. Oh, okay. Well, you'll learn some. And it's good to appreciate yourself. That's a strong thing. And yes, you have a favorite artist? Oh, do you ever look at the clouds in the summer in the sky? I would love to see your pictures sometime. And Jocelyn? That's okay. Rose? Oh, Leonardo da Vinci. He's amazing. Was an amazing person. Well, my favorite artist is Mother Nature, and one of my favorite things she makes is trees. Do you like trees? Well, I'm going to show you some amazing pictures of trees. Oh, do you like this tree?
I like that tree.
This is a beech tree.
That's a huge tree.
Well, what? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Pictures of sunsets.
Oh, sunset. The sky. I mean, Kansas has such a big sky. I think of it as our own personal movie screen, always changing, free. You never know what's going to be showing.
It's, and you don't have to pay for it.
No, no, you don't. Well, what do you think of this tree?
Oh, that is awesome.
Well, do you think it's beautiful?
I think it's beautiful, but it's kind of weird. Awesome. It's
better. Oh, for climbing. Is that part of its beauty? It's bare, right? This is probably in the winter. This is a tree in England. This is a beech tree. It's the same kind of... Oh, no, this is an oak. This is an oak. And it's at least 400 years old. Well, sometimes the sky is blue, like after... It could be in the fall. Well, oh, my gosh. What do you think this one? So some, at least one person. Why do you think this one's pretty? What's pretty about this one? Because it has flowers. Is it prettier than the tree I showed you before?
Yeah, it's pretty in a different way.
Right. That's an interesting point.
It's pretty because it has snow on the leaves.
Oh, because what? Oh, it does look like snow. And look, when the petals fall off, it looks like it snowed underneath. Well, I'll show you one more out of this book. What about this tree? This is a different oak tree. This one's probably 1,000 years old.
I know what it is.
Oh, what? Is this one beautiful, do you think?
I know what it is.
What?
It's a fat tree.
It's very wide. Well, why do you think this one's beautiful? Awesome for climbing, Rose.
Because it's very beautiful, and it looks like it's pretty. It's beautiful because it has so much life because it's been around so long.
Oh, it survived. It lost its top, but still interesting. And, okay, you have so many comments. I'll leave these books and you can look at them later. Here's some other really... Have you ever seen a tree like this? This is called a dragon's blood tree. Does it remind you of anything? Like what?
An umbrella.
A what?
Yes.
Oh, from the movie Avatar. I actually never saw the picture of this till I looked in this book. This used to be an enormous forest in Yemen. That's in the Middle East. This is kind of a desert tree. To me, it looks like an umbrella that blew up in the wind. Oh, it does, doesn't it? And okay, I'm going to show you a series of trees. These are called baobabs. They come in many different shapes. Well, do you think these are beautiful?
Yeah.
Well, are they more? Is it more beautiful than the dragon's blood tree?
No. Not as beautiful.
Not as beautiful. Okay. And what's your name? Okay, Lauren said each one is beautiful in its own way. So does that mean they're different kinds of beauty?
Yes, there's no one type of beauty.
Well, how old is that tree? Lauren says that beauty comes in all shapes and sizes, and good point. Here's a different baobab tree. Here's two different ones. Well, here's two they call the lovers. And these are also desert trees.
It looks like a cucumber.
Oh, my God. Doesn't it? A big cucumber?
That looks like a fat carrot.
Here's another baobab tree. Look how different. Well, trees have inspired many, many artists and people, and many, many people have made things out of the substance of trees. And so, what's this thing?
A piece of wood.
It's a toothpick. Is this beautiful?
No.
Well, no.
It's just a little tiny piece of wood.
Well, it's useful, isn't it? I mean, it's pointy. It's kind of stiff. I just broke it. Well, it's not real. It's not. It's fragile, right? And one end is pointy, but the other one is flat, so you can hold it and stab it into a piece of cheese or something, or use it to spread some glue on a little thing you're making.
Sometimes you can pick something out of it too.
Oh yes, very good point. It's a useful thing. It's useful, but it's simple and elegant. Is that a kind of beauty? So that's another kind of beauty. Well, a friend of mine made this. He's a farmer and a wood carver. What do you think about this?
It's a big giant spoon.
It's a big spoon. It's useful too.
And you don't eat with it.
Well, does it have some beauty about it too?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, you can use it to hold a sandwich together. That's true. Yes, this is, it's useful and beautiful, but, well, what about this one? Which one's more beautiful? Is one?
That one.
Well, why do you think that?
It's more, like, weird. It's kind of weird.
It's kind of wavy, like maybe this carver used the curve of the branch. Yes. You could. It's useful and beautiful. And I'll pass these around. You can feel how nice and smooth they are. Someone spent a lot of time making them. But what about this one? Is this one more beautiful?
That is more beautiful. That is beautiful. It looks like it was made in Morocco,
but it's less useful.
Less useful. Oh, why do you think that?
How many things can you scoop out with that kind of
thing? Oh, it's more shallow, isn't it? It's not as deep. But maybe I could do some other things with it, huh? Well, this wood's kind of stripy wood, and it has kind of an abstract elephant carved in it. Yeah, this is wood, too, but it's also really smooth and beautiful, but a different kind of beauty. Well, what do you think of this? Oh, well,
Is this useful?
Well,
you can. It's a decoration. It's something that you maybe appreciate to look at. And, well, I think that this was made in Africa, and I'm sure the carver saw this beautiful brown, rich brown wood and thought, oh, my gosh, this looks like our beautiful skin, and sanded it really smooth and left this part really rough so it looks like cloth. You can pass that around and feel it and appreciate it. That has another kind of beauty, even though it's not really useful. But what about this? This is from a tree.
What? That would be cool. Awesome. That's useful. It looks like driftwood. And my mom likes everything that looks like driftwood because she likes the ocean.
Oh, so it's interesting because it reminds you of other things, right?
It looks like coral reefs.
Uh-huh. That's a really good point. It reminds you of a lot of different things, doesn't it? So that makes it, that's being kind of an abstract thing. Oh, I'm sorry? Oh, you could play with it. I could use it to hold my glasses. But anyway. But this is, it has an, what you might call an abstract beauty. It could look like many things. And
it looks like coral reef.
Oh, like a coral reef.
Well, you've probably seen this picture.
It's been hanging in the narthex. And does this remind you of anything?
Colors.
Beautiful colors.
Rainbows.
Rainbows.
Well, okay.
It reminds me of
Okay, so we have some ideas here that it, the colors remind some people of rainbow and also of trees. And Lori Cross made this. And Lori, raise your hand so they can see where you are. Oh. Well, okay, Lori's back there. There, she's sitting by the aisle. And this is, I find this piece incredibly exciting. And someone mentioned trees, that reminds me of trees and the rainbow. The name of this piece is Abstract of Bark. And Lori was inspired by three different kinds of tree. A yew. A eucalyptus tree, and a gum tree. Did I get those in the right order? Is that the order that they were? Okay. Well, maybe even not necessarily that order. She was inspired by bark, and she used these bright colors. The trees weren't really these bright colors, but it makes me think. It's like having a light go on inside bark, and I said in my head, wow, bark is really interesting. Now when I look at a tree, I want to look more closely at the bark. Lori's made me see bark in a different way. Do you folks have any ideas about how you feel when you look at this, too?
I feel beautiful. I feel like I'm inside a rainbow.
Oh, well, that's a really nice feeling to have, yes? Oh.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm just like in rainbow and tornado.
Oh,
rainbow,
yeah. Tornado. Oh, my gosh. So you're thinking of like weather phenomena and things in the sky? And that's, see, Lori's caught, this is an abstract, like that piece of wood. It doesn't look exactly like something that you might see all the time, but it makes you think of many things. And the big people are going to be hearing a talk about what is beauty. Is beauty an exact thing, or are there different standards of beauty? And so you, all of you, have touched on many things about beauty, and the same things apply to when you meet a person, that all the objects we see, trees and other things and people, there's the external way, how they all look, and then there are the things that endear them to us because that make them special, because of some other quality about them. So I think you all are geniuses. And anyway, thank you for coming up here. And I appreciate all your things.
is from 674 in the back of our hymnal, written by Brandock Lovely. Let there be an offering to sustain and strengthen this place, which is sacred to so many of us, a community of memory and of hope, for we are now the keepers of the dream.
I sat in the professor's office and held my breath. I couldn't wait to see what he had to say about my writing. The semester of creative writing was nearly done, and he had invited each of us to have a private summary conference. I remember the light streaming in from the windows on the left. The sun rays streaked across his bookshelves, brimming with leather-bound first editions. Though I can't recall his face, other than he was lean and middle-aged, I remembered the sun glancing off his brown hair, making it seem golden. I smiled when he started speaking. "Well, Catherine, you seem intelligent and will probably make a fine English teacher." I nodded, gratified, until he continued. But he didn't even pretend to hesitate. "Not a writer. You just don't seem to have any talent." I really don't remember what I said in response. Probably a mumbled thank you. All I remember is that I felt like a Chinese glass wind chime, one that slipped its mooring and fell crashing onto the polished terrazzo floor. My secret dreams of being a writer, a storyteller, like my dad and Irish uncles, lay in fragments at my feet. What I do remember is repeating to myself, "Don't cry. Don't let that bastard see you cry." I stopped writing that day. For the next 16 years, I wrote only term papers, lesson plans, and letters, which were a struggle. Then, one happy day, I met my writing coach, Leonard Bishop. He believed in me. And that, my dear readers, changed everything.
Stand as you're able to and look at page 288. All are architects. When my brother had his piano lessons at SMU in Dallas, we waited for him in the car outside of Caruth Auditorium, the music school, and Meadows Museum. Sometimes, though, we got out and walked on the premises, which were filled with massive metal sculpture. I never understood then the Henry Moore blobs. I preferred Brian Donnelly's huge Mickey Mouse head weighted down with a great artistic link of chain. The Henry Moore ones were big and smooth, supposedly shaped like women. I wanted to climb on them like some of the other kids. I don't think Moore would have really minded. Henry Moore provided in his will for a herd of sheep to graze on his property around his works. You can go walk on his land, see his sculpture, and see sheep walking around them as you do that. 30 years past the SMU experience, I saw a Moore exhibit at the Dallas Museum of Art twice. It was a very holistic experience. Then around 10 years past that, at the Nelson Atkins in KC, I saw his sculpture amongst other artists' creations. The grandness of Moore's pieces truly outstaged the others. Why was the artistry so stunningly superior? And did everyone else there have the similar experience? Please welcome Dr. Dobrunsky.
Good morning, still morning. And, when I was asked to do a program about aesthetics, I initially said yes. Then I realized I'm not a philosopher. I teach piano performance. There is a philosopher right here, sitting right in front of me, which is even more sort of embarrassing. Initially, though, I thought, oh, I know so much about this that, well, I can talk. Then I realized that actually I don't know that much. And then I thought about Oscar Wilde, who said, I'm not young enough to know everything, which is a very interesting thought. Then we had an exchange with Jennifer, and it was still about aesthetics, and I thought about just establishing the right vocabulary and terminology here to talk about aesthetics would take about a month, and agreeing on certain definitions, what are aesthetic values, and so on. Then I started reading some books, and they all agreed on certain aspects, and there seems to be an agreement that philosophers are divided into groups. About 35% of them believes that there is such a thing as elastic objective beauty. 35% believes that there isn't, and the rest is undecided. Okay. Then I was faced with the question, what do I believe then? I don't even have the vocabulary of these philosophers. The first statement I wrote was, I do believe there is such a thing as objective beauty. The second statement I wrote, I wish there was such a thing as an objective beauty. the reason would be that there would be no discussion about whether Chopin is beautiful or not, and that would be the end. But then I realized that if there was no discussion, the world would be really a very, very boring and dull place. So what I really believe is that I wish there was such a thing as objective beauty. But then, dealing with different people on a daily basis, I know that they have a different view on beauty and different taste, and suddenly, I do respect that, and I teach different people differently too. There is certainly such a thing in humanity as the pursuit of beauty. Whether this is sort of a pursuit of some enigma that doesn't really exist is another difficult question here. I do believe, though, that there are certain standards by which we can measure if a musical work is a good work or bad work. But then immediately the standards would be depending on a particular style, a musical style. What is a good romantic composition? What is a bad romantic composition? And so on. So the standards immediately are linked to a certain tradition. So, all the books that I have studied, and I've looked at about 5 or 7, and they all agreed that arguments about music have never delivered permanent answers. And they also agree that parts of aesthetic judgment are inaccessible to rational argument. And they also agree that music reaches us in ways beyond logic. So you see the difficulty here with my lecture. There are so many aspects of this. There's tradition, there is taste, there are different styles, there is terminology, there is history, there are different people, and so on. So I decided to split the talk in maybe three parts. I'm going to define what I do, what kind of music I do, and what is it. Then I'm going to talk about the listening experience a little bit. What do we do when we listen, and what our initial responses are to a musical work. And then I'm going to, playing, I'm going to compare the beautiful choir piece, and everybody would agree here that this one was beautiful, with the not-so-beautiful piano piece that I played, and why this one would be considered beautiful and the other not-so-beautiful, and whether the being not-so-beautiful means that the piece is not good. And are these questions are completely different questions. It's a good work, but whether it's beautiful, well, that's another question. And we're also going to play a couple challenging sort of compositions for you. And I'm going to mention the spiritual value of music and how we can grow as people because there is music. So, part one is, what do I do? Well, it seems like there is plenty of music in the air. There is music in the elevators. There is music on television. There is music in the mall. There is music in your car and in your bedroom. So there are many of these exposures to music are, say, not voluntary. We are exposed to music, whether we wish so or not. And, because we cannot simply close our ears because we need them for our safety. We have to hear the approaching car and so on. So most of the, waking hours, we have our ears are functional, and yes, indeed, it is used by other people to basically expose us to whatever music they think is good for us. If you compare it with eating, well, you enter an elevator, and you have to eat a cookie. You go to the mall, someone feeds you with bonbons, and you have absolutely no saying whether you like the raspberry flavor of the day or not. You go somewhere else, like, Starbucks, and someone feeds you with marshmallows through your ears, whether you like it or not. This exposure, in many ways, is completely unprecedented. I don't think any group of humans ever were exposed to music as much as we are. And so the result is that most of music starts sounding to us the same, okay? Because we're basically in it. So, and very often we don't even know we are in a musical environment. It does something to the way we listen and react to music. Music stops being special, for example, right? On the other hand, music and the choices we make are very personal and almost intimate. What is the piece I love? It seems very, very close to us. So there's this contradiction about being in music for many hours without even, being asked for permission. And on the other hand, choosing and loving the music that says something to us at the given moment about our personal situation. So there is this issue here. what I do professionally is I deal with so-called classical music. And the idea of classical music is based on the existence of so-called classics. And, if you take think about songs that you loved as a young person or a teenager, and you think about them sometimes and you smile and you think, oh, this is so funny. I used to like this song. This is really funny. How could I like this song? So many of these so-called hits. They sort of we sort of smile when we think about them. Sometimes we feel sort of embarrassed. I used to like this tune. What was I thinking? So these kind of tunes sort of they lose their validity and sort of disappear. The idea of classics is that a Beethoven Symphony No. 5, pa-pa-pa-pa, has a lasting value that goes beyond the time of Beethoven's life or the, you know, the life of the Austrian society at the time. So Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 has survived basically many decades, and people still love it. So there must be something that there is a lasting value in that composition. So I deal with these kind of compositions, and which is based on the belief that there is a kind of music that represents, transcends time, basically. Okay. the idea that is connected with this is that music, I think along with the Enlightenment, and became an independent art. Okay, so somewhere there, by the end of the 18th century, people started gathering together just to listen. Okay, and this is completely new. And so I think also the idea that we were entitled to our own feelings is very romantic, and is also connected with the growing independence of music and what music can do for us. Okay? However, if you ask a 17th century person what is a personal musical taste, they would be completely disoriented. There was no such a thing as a personal musical taste. Music was an expression of the harmony of the planets, of the numerical relationships, you know, in the universe. Okay, so music was something objective. And there was no question, oh, I like this, I hate that other song, come back. You know, there was no such a thing. It was, I think, and that is connected with the fact that they were just simply less exposed to music. And that's how I ended up being a professor at the university, because music expresses the harmony of the universe. It's a mathematical science. Okay? Today it might seem, well, it's more like a craft, more like a skill, but the origin of me being a professor at the university is connected with the lack of the personal musical taste. It's with the objective science of music. It's very interesting. And, you know, when we talk to people, everybody has their own expectations of what music does to them. And, you know, most people say it's relaxing, it's comforting. Some people wake up and turn on the radio because it's so energizing, you know. And our choices, of course, are based on our age and education and social status and upbringing and life experience and even particular moments in life, personal loss, or, you know. It is, however, shown that whoever participated personally in making music makes different choices, makes more mature choices, goes for the more complex music. So there is a great benefit in playing or singing. Yes. I'm looking at my old father here. What we are going to do now is talk about the listening experience, and music consists of several elements, you know, and what we do when we listen, we usually go for one. We are all mostly influenced by the romantic way of listening to music. Romantic music was melody-based, you know, the melody was expression of the soul, and you know that tradition comes, of course, from the opera. So I'm going to go to the piano, and we're going to compare a couple melodies. So most people, when they think about this piece, when they think, oh, this piece is so beautiful. Well, the piece is so beautiful because it has a beautiful melody. That's sort of implied, okay? Well, this is our piece from today. Very beautiful melody. We are all very happy. We feel very, very comfortable with that one. The problem for a composer is always the composers that are gifted with the gift of composing beautiful melodies are always tricky, because what do you do after the melody ends? So how long can a melody be? We can challenge ourselves to a test. How long is our attention span? And, you know, mostly we say Mozart is for children. Well, he's not, but he sounds so simple. His melodies are very short, they're very accessible. Let's listen to the melody that Arnold Schoenberg wrote here in 1919. It's a difficult melody. It's a difficult melody. I doubt any of you are going to go home, you know, humming this tune in the car. You know. it's bizarre, but there is a melody. Okay, it's just very hard for us to follow, and the reason that it is hard for us to follow is because it's an atonal melody. The melody of our piece here for choir had a very nice harmony. And the harmony helps us understand the melody very well. It supports the melody. Here we really don't have any harmony. So we feel a little bit, lost temporarily. We just don't know what can that be possibly about. Is it because we simply have certain expectations from a musical piece? In order to satisfy us easily, we have to have a beautiful tune first. Okay. So this one is naturally harder. Well, there's one more element, and there are many elements of music, and we'll not be talking about all of them. Which is rhythm, okay? Our choir melody has a very comfortable, easy rhythm. And we don't even know it, but subconsciously we are actually counting the beats. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. Here we feel completely lost in Arnold Schoenberg piece. We don't know how to count this. Well, I do. I'll say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Sorry. 1, 2. But we're not going to, you know, move our big toe with that piece. A difficult one. Okay. I'm still insisting that it has some value, and I will show you what my easiest interpretation or explanation of the piece would be. Okay. So there are, of course, many other elements here in music, such as, you know, color, dynamic contrast. The choir piece has a fantastic, you know, crescendo, which is we go into culmination, then we release it. Tension is beautiful to sing together and feel the energy. My Schoenberg piece is all very whispery and sort of, not quite clear what's going on there. Okay. There's also color, of course. Well, there's a mood. This is a very happy mood. or a Sunday morning, you know, your heart opens. Very nice. This one is sort of, maybe the person is half asleep. Anyway, possible. Okay. And you know, there's of course style and there's form, and these are very complicated long-term study subjects for a semester or more, actually for years. I'm going to switch now briefly to the significance of music and possibly the significance for us as a community, and then I'm going to come back here. Yes, can you hear me? Yes. I looked for it, but it looks like the evolutionary significance of music has not been discovered. So we just don't know why there is music or there was music. But it has been indicated that if someone sings very loudly, plays beautifully, the person has easier time finding mates. Okay. So that's in terms of evolution. Okay. The so-called Mozart effect has been questioned. The theory currently is that Mozart's music makes us sort of puts us in good mood, and we become much better at mathematical problem solving. It's not the case with many other composers. If you listen to Schubert, you might fail your math test. So that's a problem with that. But of course, we all know that music is relaxing, stimulating. It has healing powers, and so on. For us as a community, a spiritual community, I think that the most important meaning of music is the idea of listening and the total immersion in the moment. And this kind of spiritual practice, you know, is known in many traditions, especially in Buddhism, where, you know, we should just let go of our ego and just open ourselves up to whatever is coming. It has a certain centering. On one hand, you know, is a dissolution of ego. This is a philosophical problem, and whether the ego exists or it doesn't exist is complicated. So music has a centering effect on us. We are more in touch with our center or our heart. Music has a cleansing effect. We sort of release all the, you know, negative stuff that we might have accumulated. Listening to music is actually a discipline. So, you know, we can, again, this is another subject for a semester of classes, in how many ways you can listen to music. Being a professor of music, I listen very analytically. So when I'm in an elevator, it really bothers me because, so I have to sort of cut myself off from what I don't want to hear, okay? But also, for our congregation, music can be a practice in practicing the open mind. Open mind, and, you know, realizing that there might be different definitions of beauty out there. I wanted to play for you two short pieces from music from other cultures. One is based on a Korean traditional song, and you will see there's, you know, several layers there, melody, rhythm, and some interesting combination of instruments, yet the sound quality itself is not something that we, that are based in Western music, would call instantly beautiful. So let's listen to the Korean music. So, you know, we are really challenged here, you know, in terms of, but, you know, I encourage you to this kind of, you know, to expose yourself to challenges, and at the same time, you know, we have to realize that this kind of music has its own tradition and probably more than centuries long. So again, to understand it fully, you can't just listen to it for 10 minutes and say, oh yeah, I heard that stuff. No, it's the same, you know, as Beethoven. And then you have early Beethoven, middle Beethoven, late Beethoven, and you have chamber music, you have symphonies, and also have piano trios and cello sonatas. And basically everything has many branches. Let's listen to some Indian music. Well, this one is much easier because of the repetitiousness of the rhythm underneath. We can really enjoy it. But the color of the voice, the singer's voice, is not exactly how it developed in Western Europe. So I love this one. This one is I actually keep listening to this one. This one is very relaxing for me. And actually, I learned that the less I know, the more I enjoy. It's a very interesting situation because I'm unable to, you know, come up with an assessment and, you know, and be critical. So, like one of the most beautiful moments at school last semester was when Anna Franklin stopped by and she wanted to give a lecture about yoga to my students, but she spent about 10 minutes singing the hymns. And, you know, again, because I have no knowledge of this repertoire, we were really enjoying a lot, you know. So, coming back to the piece by Arnold Schoenberg, we can write several pages of theories about this particular piece. But I'm going to tell you what my interpretation would be. Okay, so for me, this piece is a portrayal of a fleeting, vague, temporary thought of someone who is getting up in the morning, maybe in winter, where it's still dark, and the person is disoriented. So it goes more or less like this. Where am I? It's so strange. Let's look out the window. Oh, a bird. Oh, flew away. Gray winter. Does not end. And then the person, I think, goes to the kitchen. And takes some water. And then the person yawns. And says, I'm so sleepy. And there's the loudest moment in the piece. Monday is coming tomorrow. Let's go back to bed. Get some sleep. So, you know, so my advice is don't be too serious about this music. It has to relate. So that's I hope you enjoyed the program, and thanks for listening.
Jim Chanteau. Some years ago, I heard about a concept I've been fascinated about when it came to art. It's called hotel art. Hotel art is the kind of art that you would find in a hotel room that is not so good that you would steal it and not so bad that you would deface it. And based on that concept, I've wondered, is there such a thing as hotel music? Not so bad that you would, you know, want to kick the speakers and not so good that you'd want to take it away with you. But that didn't make sense. It never quite fit the same way. But I've always wondered, is there some in-between space that we tolerate without really loving or hating.
Well, you know, in terms of even hotel art, which sometimes can be very nice, has a certain desensitizing effect on us because we are being taught this is not for real, this doesn't matter. It has to be there, yeah, the people want us to feel welcome. But what role does it play in enriching our, spirit? Not sure.
Seavers, I've always considered myself a fine craftsman rather than an artist, probably because I'm in denial of all the baggage that comes with the artist issues, but it took me about 30 years to realize that one of my struggles with making pottery was when I was in a community place and throwing and working, the stress of the performance actually kind of made me raise my game, and the successes and the failures were more dramatic. But I listened to your trio performance just a week ago and was just utterly impressed, and I had just seen your solos before, and I'm curious, as a professional musician, what the difference in your challenge is when you're playing solo as opposed to your group performances?
Well, it feels safer when you have other people with you on stage. That's the first reaction that I have. If there are any differences, of course, there's a difference in, you know, the idea of collaborating and giving other people's, supporting other people's voices when they play. In terms of solo playing, the responsibility is much, you know, you don't get a break in terms of the exposure. So you are in the spotlight all the time. So it takes a different kind of attention, you know, to listen to other people. But physically and mentally, actually, it's less work, obviously, to play with other people. But you were talking about something that is connected with art. We have discredited the Mozart effect. You talked about your own standards and, you know, how doing art or playing creates the idea of personal standard. And that's why, you know, art is so important for kids to learn or participate in. So I think that's actually, you touched upon a subject that I should have mentioned. So,
great, thank you. I think specifically today I would like the ending to be hearing your own voices in the beauty of the hymn. So I will quickly tell you about my search for closing words yesterday. I got out three books off my shelves. The first I looked at for a while and didn't find what I wanted. It's a wonderful book called The Inner Game of Tennis. Then I got a book, a play, The Trip to Bountiful, which is probably my very favorite film. I grew to love it when I was 17. Geraldine Page, obviously Horton Fitt is an amazing writer, but Geraldine Page really, and the silence of that movie really brought it home for me, and it's still my favorite. I didn't quite find a quote I wanted to use from there. The third one I pulled out was about a conductor I had gotten to play under when I was 16 in New York. And he, more than any other conductors I worked with, was all about the beauty of the phrasing. And he brought music out of us that it was aged 15 to 23 in New York and Washington, D.C. over Christmas time. And actually, New York at Christmas time is a work of art itself. But it was quite an experience. So I looked in these three books, and in reading the third one, I found out that Geraldine Page and Alexander Schneider had been married. So... Anyway, let's all stand as we're able and sing hymn 303.